I hated corporate law. I mean, it was awful. Like, everybody else was so excited. And I thought, I'm going to die. Thankfully, I was able to do a project with the trust and estates lawyer who was working on a local family-owned business. And he was doing a transaction between generations. I ended up showing up at the closing where we were signing all these documents. And in the room, there were grandmother and grandfather who were not much older than I am now. They were in their 60s. There are a couple of young people in their 30s and then a tiny little baby. And you didn't get to see tiny little babies in New York corporate law firms at that time. And I thought, wow, this is really cool. And I realized everything I worked on was going to help that tiny little baby and future generations. And I basically camped out at the door of the trust estates lawyer's office. And I said, this is what I have to do. That was the early 90s. And I've only worked with families ever since.
Welcome to Talking Billions. We talk about big ideas, big inspirations, big topics. We take on the hardest subject of all, money. How to make it, save it, keep it. But our conversations lead us to an even bigger question: what it means to live a rich life beyond money. My guests share their practices, principles, and evergreen wisdom. I'm your host, Bogumil Baranowski, author, TEDx speaker, investor, and a founding partner of Sicard Associates, a boutique investment firm founded in New York City. Join me on this quest to unearth the wisdom of the ages. My guest today is Patricia Angus. She's the founder and CEO, Angus Advisory Group, LLC. She's also an adjunct professor, founding managing director of the Global Family Enterprise Program, and faculty director of Enterprising Families Executive Education at Columbia University's Graduate School of Business. She's a recognized thought leader in the field. She has provided legal and strategic advice to global families and firms with multi-generational businesses, trusts, and philanthropy for over three decades. She's a prolific author with publications including the highly acclaimed The Beneficiary Primer, a guide for beneficiaries of family trusts, and The Trustee Primer, a guide for personal trustees. Patricia Angus has served on the board of directors of global single family offices and has advised many others. Patricia Angus has been named one of the top 50 women in wealth management by Wealth Manager, a rising star by Private Asset Management, and top 50 CEOs in private client Power Women, and top 100 North American wealth advisors by City Wealth. Patricia Angus received the Interdisciplinary Award from the Family Firm Institute. She received a BA cum laude from Amherst College, a Master's in International Affairs with a concentration in International Law and Organizations from Columbia University School of International and Public Affairs, and a JD from George Washington University Law School. We're talking about what are trusts, where did they come from, what purpose do they serve, how trusts have changed over the years, two types of trusts, revocable and irrevocable. We'll hear more about what it takes to be a good trustee and a good beneficiary. Do trusts have to end? How can we define a success of a trust? Please help me welcome Patricia Angus. Hello, dear listener. I have a small favor to ask. If you're enjoying the show, please follow, subscribe, and most of all, share with everyone that would like it too. It's all word of mouth marketing. It's all up to your fingertips to make a small contribution and become an important part of the success of the show. Thank you. Well, hello, Patricia. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me join you today. Looking forward to our conversation.
Wonderful, wonderful. So as a context to our conversation, we have a shared friend, Jay Hughes, who was also a guest on the show. And you and I were talking about a couple of things, but the big picture idea is the wealth transfer between generations. And what we're witnessing already now, we might have the biggest ever wealth transfer between generations. And the topics we'll talk about today, I think, might be relevant to more people than ever before. We might have in the audience both current and future trustees and beneficiaries of trusts, or those interested in creating a trust. And you wrote two great primers for both trustees and beneficiaries. And I read them both, and I think they're a remarkable resource for anybody that wants to learn more and get more context. And I got to see some familiar concepts from a new perspective. So that was really refreshing. Before discussing the trustee and beneficiary experience more closely, I always like to start from the beginning So I'm curious to hear more about your story, how you developed an interest in this particular area, trust, estates, and family wealth.
Great. Boy, you have to go way back. You know, I'm the youngest of five, so family has always been of interest to me, and I've never thought I'm the only voice in the room. I understand the need to think of the family as a system and to deal with all of the stuff that goes on in families, whether you own a business, whether you have trusts, whatever it is. I was a lawyer in an international law firm, Kuder Brothers, and I was on the path to becoming what many of the people who had been at that firm had become, a diplomat in foreign policy, something in public policy was really where I was going. And I was doing the path that I thought made a lot of sense. You start out in New York for a couple of years, you do corporate law, maybe I would go over to the Paris office for a few years, and then I would go on to my next step, which would be in public policy or whatever it would look like. Well, something got in the way of my plan, and that was that I hated corporate law. I mean, it was awful. I didn't care about the companies. We were helping the first Chinese company have not done ADR, but actually an actual share on the New York Stock Exchange. Everybody else was so excited, and I thought, I'm going to die. I'm not even going to make it through my 2 or 3 years. How am I ever going to become a public official? Thankfully, I was able to do a project with the trust and estates lawyer who was working on a local family-owned business, and he was doing a transaction between generations for tax purposes. It's what's called a sale to defective grantor trust. I got to see those documents, and they were pretty interesting. Wills and trusts were pretty interesting to me. I ended up showing up at the closing where we were signing all these documents, and in the room, there were grandmother and grandfather who were not much older than I am now. They were in their 60s. There are a couple of young people in their 30s and then a tiny little baby. And you didn't get to see tiny little babies in New York corporate law firms at that time. And I thought, wow, this is really cool. And I realized everything I worked on was going to help that tiny little baby and future generations. And I basically camped out at the door of the trust estates lawyer's office. And I said, this is what I have to do. That was the early 90s, and I've only worked with families ever since. By coincidence in some ways, and I don't think it's enough, I had lost both my parents pretty young. So I knew what it was like to have to be in a family making decisions together. But I have a strong view that your own personal experience isn't enough. You need expertise. And so I literally would stay late at night and read the tax code. It was that bad. So I wanted to do it that badly. So no, I haven't gone into public policy. I have had an experience around the world with people who influence public policy, who have charitable foundations, who have philanthropy that I've been able to be a part of. And that's just really exciting. It's more close to home when I can see the person in the room.
You found your calling. You found something that apparently, you really enjoy. Wonderful.
I think it found me.
For those less familiar with trusts, what are they? Where did they come from? What purpose do they serve? And if you can talk more about the two concepts of ownership that you talk about in your primers, the legal and beneficial, that's not that intuitive to a lot of people.
There's a story that people tell, and in fact, trusts probably go back to Roman times, but I'll tell you the story of the Crusaders. And the reason trusts were created was because there was a problem that couldn't be solved at that time. If you imagine it's the Middle Ages, and you're in the UK, and you are going to go off, and you're male. Women were certainly not going off to the Crusades in that way. And you had a farm, and you had a couple kids, and you had a wife. And you said to your neighbor, hey, can you take care of things when I'm gone? And I'll see you in a year. Go off for a year, you come back. Your wife isn't there anymore. Your son and daughter are like living on the streets. And your property is a wreck, and your friend, former friend, is living in your house. And you say, this isn't exactly the plan that I had for you. It's mine. I own it. And the friend says, that's really nice. I own it now. And so the Crusader goes to the court, and the court says, we hate to tell you, but there's an expression that people years from now are going to be quoting, which is possession is 9/10 of the law. And during that era, whoever lived there was considered to own it. So the person who came back home had basically lost ownership of the property. My other, you know, sort of boom theory is that trusts were created because women couldn't own property. So the wife could not own it. The children couldn't own it because they were minors. So the court had to do something about this rather than saying, oh, your wife can own it. They said, no, we're going to keep it in the male line. We're going to create two forms of ownership. Legal ownership, which is the person you have assigned a trustee. Hopefully the guy picked a better friend the next time to be his mm-hmm. trustee. And then the beneficial owner, which are the, in this case, the wife and the children. They use them today for anybody, and we women can own property now. So we can set up trusts, we can be trustees, but basically you've separated somebody who's responsible for the property and somebody who gets benefits of it. So Crusader goes away the next year, he comes back and he says, show me your accounting trustee, show me the taxes you've paid. I assume you've kept track of, you know, sort of the expenses, and you've taken care of the beneficiaries, which are the case, the spouse.
When did that change? When women were allowed to own property? When did that change? And I'm sure it was different in different countries, but more or less, was there a point in time?
Last century. Last century. I mean that, but I'm not saying early in the last century. It's really a lot later. So sort of interesting to think about that.
Yeah, it gives you some context. So trusts are not a recent invention, as you mentioned, and they stood the test of time and they continue to evolve. And I'm curious what you're seeing, and I kind of saw it between the lines in your book. What's changing in the trusts, how they're written? And
I could write a whole nother book on what trusts are today versus what they were then. I tell you, the court of equity, which was the court, the equity meaning fairness, which had to create the original separation of legal and beneficial ownership, they would be rolling over in their graves if they saw what was going on with trusts today. There are a lot of ways that you can find a lot more flexibility today in both the way trusts are set up, the way that they're handled, and what happens along the way with them. For example, in the past, a trustee had to do the three things that trustees must do. You administer whatever you've received. You invest, whether it's financial, a house, property, whatever it is, and you distribute. Today, you can have separate trustees essentially for each of those so that you don't have one trustee doing everything. And there are jurisdictions in the U.S. and around the world that have been consistently for the past 20 or 30 years changing the law to give more flexibility on trusteeship in a way to give more visibility from the beneficiary standpoint into what's going on in the trusts as well. And also what you can do if you're not happy with how the trust is currently written. So in the past, pretty much you'd write the trust, depending on what type you wrote, and it would be set in stone. Now you have ways to decant, which is really pretty cool. It's not just wine. You can decant a trust. See, trusts are cool, Bougainville. I don't know if you realize that. But you can what's called pouring one trust into another trust to add more modern terms into it, which is really essential if you're strapped in a trust from long ago. So there's lots of different ways, a lot more flexibility, a lot more division of responsibilities among trustees. And in fact, more control that people might have over them than in the past, which I can say I'm a bit concerned about. Sometimes, you know, if you read an ad in the paper or wherever one reads it on the internet, you know, hey, you can control all your money and put it in a trust, not necessarily to get benefits you're looking for. So something to think about.
I witnessed a decanting of a trust. It's quite something to watch and see. And then the consequences, it's really interesting. I learned a lot.
Multi-steps.
Exactly. You touched something interesting just now, irrevocable trusts, control or no control eventually. Can you talk about it a little bit more to introduce the audience to the two concepts?
I loved Latin. I'm sort of a nerd that way. And if you think of Latin, you'll remember the difference between revocable and irrevocable. Revocare means to call back. Okay. So revocable means you can call back the trust. You can cancel it any time. For that reason, in the U.S. and most jurisdictions, you're considered to still own that property. What does that mean? You're still taxed on it here. You are still considered the owner for creditor purposes. So if somebody is suing you, you can't say, I put it in trust. It's not mine. It's still yours from an ownership standpoint and from a property standpoint, essentially, and from a tax standpoint. Irrevocable means you've given up ownership and control. And that's more along the lines of what I described with the Crusaders and really what most effective trusts for tax and property planning are irrevocable. You can't call the property back. You may be able to have some flexibility with terms through decanting. One is a lot more permanent than the other.
I'm curious about the moment when somebody becomes a trustee, and you write about it in the book, how it means that somebody considered you trustworthy, better than the friend of the Crusader, and competent, and that should make you feel good. What's the first advice would you have for somebody that was just asked to become a trustee of a trust?
Think long and hard. First, know whether it's revocable or irrevocable. You know, if you're worried, you'd rather be a trustee of a revocable trust than an irrevocable trust, because the settlor, who's the person who set it up, can take it back. So you don't have as high a level of responsibility. However, you should be thinking, another thought on the irrevocable part, you can set up a trust during your lifetime that's revocable. Right. When you're gone, i.e. you're gone from this earth, the trust becomes irrevocable. So as a trustee, you've been named, you have to find out, is it revocable or irrevocable? Mm-hmm. And you have to get a copy of the trust agreement and either read it yourself, have somebody read it to you, understand the terms, understand what you've been asked to do. No two trusts are the same. Every trust has different terms depending on what the settlor who created into there. Are mm-hmm. you comfortable with those terms? Are you comfortable with doing what it's asked you to do? If somebody asked me to invest $250 million on their behalf as the trustee, I would say, thank you very much. I could be the trustee on distribution, maybe on administration, but investing, you don't want me managing your $250 million. I'm not qualified to do that. So are you qualified? Mm-hmm. And what have you been asked to do is critical. And then do you honestly have the skills to do that? And so I think that's part of, you know, it's easier to know whether you're qualified to invest. It's easy to know whether you're qualified to administer. And in fact, having a good, you know, system behind you, having access to the accountants who will do the fiduciary accountings, which is different from just regular accounting. It's a lot more complicated. You can get experts at that. If you've been asked to be responsible for distributing to people, if it's a family member, just imagine the change in dynamics that you have. Mm-hmm. If it is a friend, you will be in a position that feels like more power over them. Be really honest with yourself. Is that the relationship you want to have? Because the other really cool thing about a trust is that it is a fiduciary relationship. The trustee has a duty to that beneficiary that goes beyond. It's like one of the highest levels in the law. You're responsible to that person. Are you comfortable with that? Are you okay with making the decisions it's going to, you know, require it? And it's okay to resign. It's okay to say no. You know? Mm-hmm. I think too many people accept and then realize, oh my God, I'm in over.
It's a big ask.
It's a big ask. Exactly.
Makes you feel good, but you have to understand what comes with it.
Absolutely. And if you really want to rise to the occasion, it's pretty amazing as an experience.
What about the beneficiary experience? You write that you may feel fortunate that somebody thought about you, you left something for you to help you in your life's journey. I think it's beautifully said. But it can be also an overwhelming experience when you find out that you're a beneficiary of a trust.
Absolutely. And I can imagine that some of the people listening to this may have heard the term trust fund baby. We mm-hmm. talk about it a lot in the U.S., and people talk about it with derision, and they look down on people who are dependent on a trust for their financial welfare. I'm here to say it's not the beneficiary's fault, okay? Very often in the past, the relationship between the beneficiary and trustee felt so imbalanced from a power standpoint. You had younger people and older people who were treated as children for their whole lives. Mm-hmm. I used to, when I was practicing law, I worked with one client who was in his 60s or 70s and really felt as though everybody thought of him still as a child. So if you're the beneficiary, you have to address sort of what that means. Can you be a grown-up with this trust? You've got to also read the terms of the trust. You have to understand what's your obligation and what's the trustee's obligation. You don't just sit back and wait for checks to arrive and then complain if they're not in the amount that you want. Because under the distribution side of things, the trustee might have to automatically pay you a certain amount every quarter, every month, every year, or not. Mm-hmm. They may have to only give it to you for health and you're asking for education. It might say health, education, maintenance, and you want to take a trip around the world that's not especially educational, whatever. It might be educational. Know what is the trustee's position and their obligations, and then you'll have a much better sense of where you fit. I think it's really important. It's too easy to say that the beneficiary just has this sort of manna from heaven that just sits down. It's actually work to do as well. Stay engaged.
Mm-hmm. There's a certain responsibility that comes with it.
Absolutely.
I like that aspect that you discuss in both books, the relationships that a trust creates. So you have the trustees, you have the beneficiaries, you have the remainder person, you have the original settlor of the trust. And then you also mentioned the finally, the beneficiary's relationship with themselves, with oneself, which I thought was interesting, because how do you respond to the fact that you're part of this experience? Can you talk more about the intricate relationships that a trust creates between all, among all the participants?
Sure. We have 3 days, 4 or 5. This is, in a way, the crux of the matter, right?
Uh-huh.
You've set up this person, the trustee, who's the legal owner. You've set up somebody else as the beneficial owner. And the person I mentioned before, the settlor, sets it all in motion. So let's talk about the settlor for a second. The settlor is probably doing this because they want to take care of their family over time. Maybe you have a minor child. Maybe you have somebody who doesn't know how to manage money. Maybe you have somebody with a health issue, right? So the settlor is doing it in order to help people. In the past, often trusts were set up after the settlor was gone. As I said, you know, you create revocable during life and it becomes irrevocable. So the settlor wasn't around when the trust was in process. Today, you have settlors setting up trusts and they are living alongside the trust. They often forget that they gave up ownership and control of the property. And so the most important thing for a settlor is to think about, before you set up this trust, if it's irrevocable, are you comfortable not seeing that money ever again, or that house, or that whatever it is? They call it grantor's regret. It happened a lot during the dot-com era out in Silicon Valley. I remember sitting next to somebody at dinner one night who said, if I'd ever known I was going to make my children more wealthy than I was, I never would have set up that trust. So know for a settlor what's going on. You're giving it up. The trustee has to figure out, am I going to act like the parent to this beneficiary, or am I going to act like a partner? And I would say being a partner is far more productive for both of you. This is not a parent-child relationship. Both sides are more equal, even if it is still a child who is the beneficiary. I would think about that for that person. The beneficiary, the relationship with oneself. Too often, beneficiaries say, this trust was set up because my father, my mother, my grandmother didn't trust me. I'm a grown-up. I should have it all to myself. I should have complete ownership over this. They forget all the other benefits of the trust. They forget all the other reasons that were behind it. Rarely have I seen somebody set up a trust because they didn't trust their children. It's usually there's a whole set of motivations. The trust beneficiary has to think about, am I taking responsibility to understand really all the motivations? And am I taking responsibility, even if I don't like those motivations, to live with it as a grown-up? And to live with it as an empowered person who is engaged in this relationship. The final person you talked about, the remainder person, what's really cool about trust is you're setting up something that can last across generations.
Mm-hmm.
And so in a trust, you have a beneficiary who's currently to benefit from it. And then when they die or after a certain period of time, the next person who can benefit from it is a remainder person. So as a trustee, you have to feel comfortable with balancing the interests of this current person who you're talking to today with somebody who frankly may not even be born. What is that impact going to be? So if the trust says, I want this to last for 3 generations, you don't pay it all out in the first month.
Mm-hmm. You keep that in mind.
Yeah. And, you know, and a lot of people in our field talk about the trust beneficiary. So that's the only thing they're doing in life. If you put too much emphasis on the trust, you'll forget that this is just one part of what you're living with. You are a fully engaged person in the world, and this is just one part of it. So that's the relationship with yourself. Are you going to let it overshadow you and overwhelm you, or are you going to figure out what you need? Well,
I like that. I know it's a big and broad question, but being a good trustee and being a good beneficiary, I'm curious, what do you think? And I know it could be a whole other conversation. and you mentioned... Yeah. What I liked a lot, the positive impact of a trust at the end of the day. And I thought it was an interesting observation. You mentioned more than once that at the end of the day, it has to be a positive impact.
Sure. When you think of a good trustee, they're looking out for the interest of the beneficiary even more than themselves. Well, of course, a trustee has liability, something we haven't talked about, right?
Yes.
If they don't abide by the terms of the trust, they can be sued. Mm-hmm. That shouldn't be what you're thinking about as a trustee. You should be thinking about, how am I going to enhance this beneficiary's life with this trust, given the parameters that I need to live with? You have to know the terms. I can't tell you how many people I've met with over the years who say, oh, I think my uncle named me as trustee of something. I even had a client who was moving a trust account to an investment firm where I was working. And I said, well, let me talk to the trustee and we'll have that person sign the documents. The trustee had died 10 years before and nobody had bothered to figure that out. But so... I can't say the trustee was a bad trustee. Everybody in the ecosystem ignored the trust. So being a good trustee means know enough of the law, enough of investing, enough of fiduciary accounting and financial issues. Know the terms, and understand the other's position. As a beneficiary, you have to understand what the trustee is obligated to do, not just what you want out of it. And you have to take it seriously, but understand that you're human. So I've often seen beneficiaries who hold trustees to a standard that none of us should hold, be held to, mm-hmm. and that they haven't done their own work. So do your own work and you can have a really good relationship out of it. Thinking about whether you're a good trustee, are you objective? Are you pretty organized? Do you listen? And as a beneficiary, can you deal with the fact that you didn't create this relationship, but you're going to make more out?
I like that. I'm curious about the end of a trust. And if you have some thoughts about it, do they have to end? They used to end. They don't have to end anymore. Is it good? Is it bad? What's the context today about trust ending or not?
It's good, bad, and indifferent. I was just on a call last week with somebody whose family is reaching the end of some trusts. You know, in the U.S., the Rockefeller family set up trusts 100 years ago that are ending now. Mm-hmm. So if you think back to England, merry old England, they love land over there. They love property. So trusts would have been set up back then to own property, to own a home and the estate around it. Well, imagine you're the neighbor and you're watching generation after generation in the same family. And you're saying, I thought we had free access to property and land in this country. Why does that family get to own it forever? So in order to deal with the fact that some people owned things forever, they created what was called the rule against perpetuities. And the rule against perpetuities says a trust can't last forever. And the way they determined was it was about 80 to 100 years. They said, anybody who's alive that day, fine. During their lifetime, you can have it. And probably for like 21 years afterwards, which was really thinking about a generation and a half, you could have something held up in trust.
Right.
Well, charitable trusts were never subject to that. They've been allowed to last forever. And especially here in the U.S. and then in other jurisdictions, some people said that wasn't long enough. They wanted trust to last more than 100 years. So the trust companies went to places like Delaware, South Dakota, Nevada, Alaska, New Hampshire. The list is getting longer and said, can't we just have trust last forever? That old rule that, you know, it has to end doesn't really mean anything anymore. And jurisdictions, in order to gather trust business to meet the needs of their trust companies, and I'm being very straight about this, changed the law and got rid of the rule against perpetuity. So more and more jurisdictions now allow you to have a trust that lasts forever. And they are called often dynasty trusts because they're supposed to, you know, be for more than a generation. Then. So it's something to think about. Are they good or bad? I think it's really strange to think about a client saying, okay, five generations from now, I want to determine what happens with the property I have today. I personally think that it's gone a bit too far with the idea that you would hold things in trust forever. But it also has other, you know, tax implications in the U.S. You know, we have a tax at every generation. And if you've skipped a generation, we even have a tax at that point, a generation skipping. Tax, if you've been able to use your exemptions from this and put it into these perpetual trusts, you may avoid tax for multiple generations. And I think there's a real public policy question around that. So it's more a tax question than a trust question, in my mind.
That's fair. Well, it ties well with my last question for the day, which is about the success of a trust. How would you define it? Is there a way to define a success of a trust? This was a successful trust. Some of the trusts that you mentioned that are expiring, how would you define that they reached the target they had and we should be happy with the outcome? How would you know?
Most people will calculate it financially. And most people will say, I mean, literally, they save billions of dollars in taxes, especially in the U.S. and around places. So, wow, you've gotten it down X number of generations, so you've saved taxes. You could calculate it financially. You could also say that we provided support for the family. We had somebody investing for someone who wasn't capable of investing. We had somebody who was taking care of someone with Down syndrome. We had somebody who was able to live a life. Maybe you're an artist, although frankly, artists often ask the best questions or are the most strategic thinkers. My theory is photojournalists are the best at this because they see stuff that other people don't see. They're not heard because they don't speak the same financial language. But a successful trust has supported somebody in the life they're trying to live and hasn't controlled them so much that they've squeezed the freedom out of their lives, which is what's so ironic in the US and the UK. We love freedom and then we put everybody in trust and then we try and squelch their freedom. So if you've kept some freedom in there. And as a final word, I'd say, you know, is it good for society too? I think that's our question. As I was talking about perpetual trust, if a family's able to not pay taxes for five generations when everybody else around them is paying, is that the right success out of the trust? So I think I have more of a problem with the sort of tax side than with the trust side. But I've seen plenty of successful trusts. I've seen people living lives they never would have been able to because of it. But part of it is having the conversations about it. That's a successful trust. Respect for each other. Neither side, treating like a child and the other treating them like a parent. Be partners. And think about what happens at the end in advance. So if you want to study the rule against perpetuities, I recommend you see the movie The Descendants. So in The Descendants, George Clooney is stuck with the dilemma that his family trust is coming to an end. And they've owned a lot of property and business, and they, as a family, have to figure out what they're going to do. A lot of it is on him because he's the trustee, but I'd say just as much as on the family. What does this money mean to you? What does this legacy mean to you? What is the purpose of it all? If you're not asking those questions, then I don't see a trust helping you out much, no matter what value it is.
Yeah, I like to think about a positive impact. Whether it's the initial single decision, but the whole process and all the relationships as we go on, can we reach a positive impact at the end?
Yeah. I'd say it's also just like money. A lot of people will say that having money destroys you. And I have certainly seen the destruction that wealth can have on people in that way. But if you think of wealth more broadly and you think about who you are as a human being and are you productive and contributing to the world, you could have nothing. You could have a lot. You could have a trust. That's more important.
I like that. Patricia, thank you so much. This was wonderful. I know we covered so much, and I recommend both books to everybody, and I'll include links in the notes. Patricia, thank you so much.
Thanks so much. Enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you. You were listening to Talking Billions. We talk about big ideas, big inspirations, big topics. We take on the hardest subject of all, money. But our conversations lead us to an even bigger question, what it means to live a rich life beyond money. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment and follow, subscribe, rate, and share with friends and family. We rely on word of mouth to promote the show. One click for you means the world to us. Thank you. Until next time, your host, Bogumil Baranowski. The content of this podcast is for general informational purposes only, and so are the opinions of members of Sicard Associates, a registered investment advisor, and guests of the show. This podcast does not constitute a recommendation to buy or sell any specific security or financial instruments or provide investment advice or service. Past performance is not indicative of future results. More information on Sicard Associates is available in its Form ADV disclosure documents available at advisorinfo.sec.gov.